All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to the In Liberty and Health podcast. I'm very, very excited for today's conversation. We're going to be talking about BRICS, China, and the stuff that I really, really care about and that really animates me when it comes to this whole political kind of scene and specifically foreign policy. And this guest today had came to me highly, highly recommended from a friend of the show, Jason Smith, who's been on a couple times. And I talk to him frequently whenever I see something going on that doesn't seem quite right, specifically when it comes to China. So I've been trying to do as much as I can to dig into BRICS and kind of understanding the economic turmoil that essentially is the US and its, you know, economic power waning and as BRICS is growing. So hopefully my guest today will be able to lay all this stuff out clearly for us today. So but before we get into today's conversation, please go to all the links below where you can find my guest, his Substack, and everything that he's got going on. And of course, you can go to all the links below where you can find me and everything I've got going on. I just started Substack recently. If you guys are into heavy metal music and kind of want stuff like that, I'm going to be writing specifically about that there. But of course, if you're watching on YouTube, Rumble, or Twitter, please like the stream, retweet it. Do whatever you can to support me because my daughter's going to be here within a few weeks. So I need all the support I can get. Anyways, without further ado, guys, let's roll the introduction and we will get into today's conversation about BRICS and everything about that.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And welcoming to the show today, I have Warwick Powell with me. How you doing?
I'm very, very well, Kyle. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. So why don't you give the audience a little bit of an introduction to who you are and what it is exactly that you do?
Look, I mainly wear two hats. I have a research hat where I'm an adjunct professor at Queensland University of Technology, and I'm a senior fellow at Taiher Institute, which is a research think tank. Headquartered in Beijing. And when I'm wearing my research hat, I focus mainly on the intersection of digital technology, cross-border payments, supply chains, international geopolitical economy, and those sorts of things. And when I'm not wearing those hats, I'm also the founding chair of a small research and development technology and trading enterprise called Smart Trade Networks, which often brings to life some of the research that I'm involved in, and is also heavily involved in training individuals and organizations in areas of digital capacity building and coping really with both the challenges of the world as it is at the moment and looking for ways in which they can create opportunities to, if at a minimum, get through, but hopefully also do a little bit better than getting through.
Awesome. Well, like I said in the introduction, Jason Smith had recommended you highly, and I've listened to quite a few interviews that you've done, and I find it absolutely fascinating to kind of learn about this whole other section of the world, because coming from the United States, of course, we're kind of the global empire and we're told that everything we do is so great. And now specifically, we're seeing all about tariffs now, which I really, really want to pick your brain about. I have a little bit of a hypothesis, and maybe this would be a good place for us to kind of start. I think Trump coming in and initiating this trade war, which we know that Biden had maintained a lot of the Trump tariffs from the end of his first term, it seems like Trump doesn't quite understand that the West is kind of waning in power, and BRICS, China, Russia, and these other nations are starting to grow in power, and that they don't need access to dollar-denominated debt and dollar-denominated economies anymore. And it doesn't seem like Trump's quite come to grips with that reality. So what do you think about kind of BRICS becoming a rising power and basically replacing the same market share that the U.S. took up for China's economic power. Do you think that's kind of like a reasonable proposition that I'm looking at, or do you think it's a little bit more complicated? I'm really curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, look, if you just take a broad brush, and it's always a good place to start, right, to take a very broad brush to get a sense of what big picture looks like, the big moving pieces, if you will. The picture that you're painting, if I use my language to describe it, is one in which the US economy has, over a period of time, progressively become decentered. So for a large part of the US economy really was central to much of what was going on in other parts of the world, either as a market for products. But importantly, in the early days, the United States was actually the world's largest manufacturing nation and supplied markets around the world. So for the period, say, 1945 through to, say, 1970, so roughly that 25-year period, the United States was actually the largest manufacturer in the world and was also actually the exporter of food across the world as well, right? So it played a really central role. Financially, in terms of capital, it was also the dominant player, either directly through foreign direct investments from American companies into other places, but also indirectly through the provision of US dollar denominated finance through the institutions created after the Second World War, such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. But progressively, since the 1970s onwards, we've seen an evolution in the way that the global system works. And what we've seen is an evolution away from a structure where there is essentially one large piece in the center and a couple of largish pieces attached tightly to that center, feeding out to a network of peripheral economies. We are now starting to see the emergence of multiple significant centers of economic gravity where they don't just have their own ecosystems separated from each other, but if you visualize a neural network, right? You know, those images we have of neural networks where you've got these concentrations of color and energy, but the sparks are flying in all sorts of directions, and the connections are like a lattice work or a spider's web. That's increasingly what the world looks like. Now, if you're coming from a place where your entire mental map of the world saw yourself literally at the heart and at the top, to a world that looks increasingly like that lattice work web network, there's a lot of displacement happening here, right? And it means that economic power is diminishing. Now, when people say that, of course, they often think in absolute terms. Oh, you know, United States is falling, collapsing, declining, or whatever.
Yeah.
If I think of this using the language of decentering, and I guess one of the reasons why I do that, Kyle, is to sort of get away from the idea that one necessarily is rising and the other one's collapsing and one's taking over. But firstly, start with the idea that we're just living through change and these systems are constantly changing. And it's the change that shifts the relative economic significance of different players at different times. And as a result of that, it also changes the extent of economic leverage that different players have at different points in time. Mm. In saying all of that, that's not to say that the United States economy isn't a big economy. It is. It's not to say that the United States doesn't make things. It does. The United States remains the world's second largest manufacturing nation. Right? Let's not forget that. A lot of people talk about the United States doesn't make anything anymore. That's not entirely true. The United States makes a lot of stuff, but the stuff that it makes is at the top end. It's the stuff in the military industrial system, the semiconductors. What the United States makes a lot less of today than it ever did are the things that ordinary people experience in their day-to-day lives. So 40 years ago, if you looked around a typical household in the United States, most of the things in that household, from toasters through to refrigerators and furniture and linen and curtains and all those things, shoes, clothes, backpacks for children, They were all made in the United States, and they were probably made in a factory not that far away from where people lived. So there was this real sense of knowing where stuff came from, that you were connected to it. But today, of course, most of the things that people have in their ordinary lives aren't made in your neighborhood or in your state. They come from some far-flung part of the world, and you no longer have that deep emotional connection with the product anymore. So a product has gone from something where you know it got made down the road to something that you just buy and throw away when you don't want it anymore. So these are the changes that have been happening. What President Trump, in a sense, represents, from my point of view, is a reaction to these changes and is symptomatic of what I've called displacement anxiety, which is to have that experience of no longer being without dispute, unquestioned at the heart of the global system. And the reactions to all of that, in part, is to lash out at others, is to often blame others for some of the challenges that the United States is experiencing, as part of a way of trying to find a way through, right? Either by reasserting primacy or reclaiming the top dog status, or eventually having to figure out that the world around us all has changed, and the way that the United States political elite need to think about the United States is also just going to have to change as well. So that's probably how I would describe where things are at today, which adds on to, I think, your very big brush picture, and hopefully sheds a little bit more light and gives your viewers a few more tools and also some mental images that they can use to think about the world.
Okay. Yeah. I actually think that's a really, really good kind of direction to go as well, because it seems like the worldview that you're kind of painting here is very, very nuanced, which I think is appropriate, because I think a lot of what we would say the China hawks, your Elbridge Colby, your Marco Rubio, the kind of guys that populate the State Department now, essentially seem to have this idea that China is going to surpass the US, and this is like a definite thing, and that the US is like, there is this constant struggle for the top. But I think the picture you're kind of painting, and once again, you could correct me if I'm mistaken, but kind of like, just things are going to be a little bit more decentralized, and basically like, oh, well, China's going to have their own economic block and their influence and their trade networks. The US is going to have their own, while we still produce stuff, China's still going to produce stuff. There's not necessarily going to be one, you know, head honcho in the entire world anymore, because Russia and China are kind of increasing in their influence and also in their economic output. Does that seem about correct?
And look, that is the displacement that's going on. And so in times past, over, say, the last 400 or 500 years, as the top dog or head honcho has progressively receded, they've normally been replaced by a single other, right? So the UK or the British Empire receded and largely was replaced by the United States Empire with, some European vassalage around it. And prior to the UK, we had the Dutch and things. So as you sort of work your way back, one replaced another. But the changes that I think are happening in the world at the moment means that system itself is actually changing, whereby we're not having one replacing another. The United States isn't actually just being replaced by China with the system being the same. Mm-hmm. It's actually the fundamental pieces of the system and the dynamics of the system that are changing. And so you do have not just China and Russia, which of course come to mind always, but a whole web of emerging what I guess you'd call middle economies. So no longer do we have this obvious sense of center and periphery, and even the semi-periphery in historical terms were always much further down the ladder, so to speak. But you've got a bunch of emerging middle economies that are not insignificant in their own right, and they are connected not just to one of the poles or one of the nodes, but are connected to all of them in different ways. And they are connected in multiple directions as well, right? So this is this issue of trade and capital flows. None of these relationships are one-dimensional. None of them are one-directional. And in that environment, of course, it's a lot more complicated the world in many ways is always straightforward if one person gets to tell everyone else what to do, right? Mm-hmm. I think we all know that in our own lives too, right? But we also have worked out that, in fact, generally speaking, the world doesn't seem to work like that, and we have to find ways of navigating a lot more complexity. And an environment with many nodes interacting with each other has the potential to, in a sense, create a set of peaceful interactions, because there's so much intertwining and the balances of power are relatively even, and that the players involved recognize that there's actually very little opportunity to gain upper hands by being belligerent. So in a sense, the system forces a kind of behavioral response. The risk, of course, is actually that there's a fine line between what I've just described mm-hmm. and the system becoming increasingly violent at the edges and increasingly chaotic as some of the major players try to find ways of exploiting tensions across the system to assert their own primacy over parts of the system. So a lot of the things that we witness today are symptoms of these two big dynamics at work about how this multinodal or multipolar world actually unfolds and comes into existence.
Mm. Yeah, and I think we're really kind of seeing this. So one thing I also kind of wanted to ask you about was I kind of look into the geopolitical perspective of the U.S. looking at China, because everyone, you know, has talked about Russia, Ukraine, Israel, and Iran, which all these things are important. But if you read the national defense strategies laid out every couple years, the U.S. always says China's the number one threat. And it seems to me like China doesn't quite view the U.S. in the same light. Like, China definitely sees the U.S. as a competitor, but they don't see them as being somebody that they have to be hostile to. They feel like they have to respond from time to time when the U.S. does hostile acts towards China, which they do quite a bit. But in my experience and the people I've talked to, Carl Zaw, Q. Anthony Lee, listening to you, Danny Haifong, and some of these people, it seems like China bases a lot of their international relations on win-win negotiations. And people could debate, hey, you know, maybe they're doing debt trap diplomacy down in Africa. I just don't know enough to litigate that. But it does seem like China's overall incentive, specifically the way their economy is set up, like they kind of need a lot more win-win negotiations. Whereas something that you mentioned earlier is that the U.S. manufactures a lot of like bombs and military equipment, which puts us at the second highest manufacturing country in the world. It seems like we tend to gross out in ventures that end in, unfortunately, profit and blood rather than, you know, profit for both people on both sides. So, one thing that I guess we could probably start with from this whole tangent is how is China's perspective on the war in Ukraine? I've heard that like China has an incentive to kind of want this war to end because they would import a lot of grain from Ukraine. What do you know about that, and what's your perspective on kind of China and Ukraine?
Look, I'll start with slightly big picture and then drill sure. in. So as you touched on, different countries, it would seem, have very different ways of conceptualizing how the world works, and how, and therefore how they shape their own conduct in the world. Mm-hmm. The United States tends to view the world through this prism of peer adversaries. Mm-hmm. So there's all the small countries that are relatively subordinate and easy to deal with, if you will, historically. And then there are now this emerging world of peer adversaries. And when Marco Rubio in, I think it was January or might have been early February, talked about a recognition that the world was multipolar, mm-hmm. he had a very particular understanding of what that was. And for him, it really meant major power competition seeking to assert influence over spheres of influence. So that was the Rubio view of multipolarity. At about the same time when he gave that interview and he introduced the idea that the United States, you know, most senior diplomat recognized multipolarity, China's leading diplomat Wang Yi also gave a speech And he talked about multipolarity in a totally different way, right? Mm. So even using this word, multipolarity actually comes with its own baggage, if you will. And Wang Yi's sense of multipolarity is that the world is comprised of a large number, 200 plus, interconnected countries whose fates individually are tied intrinsically to the fates of everyone else. And so advancing your own objectives is not done through a framework that views the world as one of contest over spheres of influence, but one of trying to work out how your fate, being intertwined with the fate of everyone else, can be advanced in ways that don't undermine the often fragile intertwinings that exist. So again, it's the imagery of that mesh network, that fabric that's intertwined with each other and that is always intertwined with each other, versus this idea that countries come to the world as standalone things and then seek to assert influence over spheres. So these are very, very different views. And once you've got these different starting points, you also tend to frame behaviors differently too. So the United States frames its own behavior around assumptions, not only about its sense of what it should be doing, but about how it assesses what others may do. So the United States will then view China basically through the lens of the United States. China, on the other hand, because it's framing the world as this set of intertwined, if sometimes fragile, fates, is looking for ways in which it can strengthen those intertwinings so as to advance the fates of themselves as well as others. And that leads to a much more collaborative, if you will, mentality about how you need to behave in relation to others. And as more countries think in those terms and frame the world in those terms, it actually makes it very difficult for those who view the world as isolated islands that then seek to divide and conquer to prevail. And I think that that's actually another source of the tensions, is that an organization like BRICS has lots of differences across its members. Mm-hmm. And Western commentators about BRICS are always honing in on these differences, either talking about them as the reason why BRICS is going to fall apart tomorrow, or why BRICS can't do anything because there's too many differences. And yet, the interesting thing about an organization like BRICS is how it actually does what it does in spite of all of these differences. And it's because the members frame the world in a different way, and through that, they understand their own relationships with each other differently. So that's the big picture. On the question of Ukraine, China's position officially for many, many years across conflicts around the world is that it doesn't support participants militarily to start with. So it doesn't supply armaments to folk who are engaged in war. Obviously, China is an exporter of defense equipment, but it doesn't export or sell defense equipment to those who are engaged in conflict. The second thing is that China has, of course, long-standing relationships with both Ukraine as a sovereign state post-1991 and with Russia. And it has, deep trading and economic relationships with them both. Ukraine has been an important trading partner for China. Even during the course of the conflict, trade has continued. So from the point of view of a country like China, its first attitude, I guess, towards a conflict like that is, look, countries have disputes amongst themselves. That happens. Let's try to resolve those as quickly as we can without resort to violence. And should violence break out, let's try to get to a point where the violence can stop and we can move on. So you'll remember that at the beginning of 2024 or late 2023, China articulated what it called its framework, I guess, mm-hmm. or position in relation to Ukraine, and it hasn't changed. Now, its position was not a peace plan. It didn't say, you must do this, you must do that, and then, you know, something will happen. What it said was, if the aim is to end the conflict, stop the war, and come out the other end with some semblance of a modus vivendi or a detente, here's a whole bunch of things that must be addressed. And the first two things, of course, are the most difficult ones. One was to acknowledge that Russia has legitimate security interests on the one hand, whilst also acknowledging territorial integrity on the other. Now, many commentators saw that as a contradictory position. China's point is that this is the heart of the conflict. So you actually need to acknowledge these two things and then find a way that the parties can agree to how to address these two things. Because if you don't, you can never resolve the conflict, right? Mm-hmm. So unless you address and acknowledge that Russia has legitimate security concerns, you're not going to resolve what Russia calls the root causes. But unless you also respect the fact that Ukraine has territorial integrity concerns and legitimate ones, you're not going to be able to bring them to the table either, right? So that's its position. I know that in recent times, there's been some media coverage about how Wang Yi told the Kallas, in effect, the foreign affairs minister for the EU as a whole, that China is not going to let Russia fail. Now, China's never made any comments in relation to that at all. Mm-hmm. It looks like my own interpretation of the media story was that it was actually something the Europeans leaked to the media, mm-hmm. and they shaped it in a very particular way. Because what they've been trying to do is put pressure on China to stop trading with Russia. So this was an attempt to say, China's clearly on Russia's side, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, China's position is a lot more subtle than this. It really has no particularly strong interest in perpetuating wars around the world because it knows what goes around comes around, right? This is the other thing. It has no interest in perpetuating wars, but it has limited influence as well. Right? So this is the other thing that people often forget, is that China has never built a military with the intention of being able to project power around the world. So in a military sense, it has actually limited influence beyond its own immediate, territory. Economically, of course, it has some leverage, but it doesn't exploit economic leverage, willy-nilly. And certainly doesn't do it just for the sake of, tackling what is quite clearly, from China's point of view, a complex problem. Mm-hmm. Right. So China's approach to conflicts is you can't solve conflicts unless...
There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation, but the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
To acknowledge the complexity of their causes, the parties involved in the conflicts must, in the end, own the solution. Otherwise, there's never going to be a real solution. And therefore, you can't impose solutions at the end of the barrel of a gun, right? So you can't just waltz into a place, exercise your leverage, tell people what to do, and then threaten them, because that's not sustainable. Right. And that's where I think China's at in relation to the Ukraine-Russia thing. It knows it's complicated. It can't be resolved simply by badgering people. It regrets and I think is at times very disappointed and arguably very angry about how the United States, on the one hand, talks about wanting to bring peace, but at the same time contributes military armaments, which frustrates the efforts. So you might have, and the last thing I'll say is probably just, again, a general remark to help people think about how China approaches this. You've probably heard China's President Xi Jinping at times talk about you have to create the right conditions for different things. And this is the point. To get an outcome in Ukraine, you've got to figure out what all the issues are, and then you've got to create the right conditions to move the agenda forward. Mm-hmm. And when you threaten sanctions and impose sanctions and continue supplying armaments and badger people and all these sorts of things, it's actually very hard to create the conditions that you need to get meaningful dialogue happening.
Yeah, and much to that point, I think a lot of people here in the United States had supported Donald Trump because they were under the impression that he was going to do something, or like Xi Jinping would say, create the conditions to bring the Russia-Ukraine war to an end. But it seems pretty obvious at this point, when he's using the same methods that Joe Biden used to send weapons in, the presidential drawdown authority to send $330 million worth of weapons in Ukraine. I can't see how Putin sees that and says, you know, I think we're ready to come to the table to talk. I think if anything, he probably sees that as, well, it's more of the same, so we're just going to keep on keeping on.
I think you're right. Absolutely, no doubt. You know, sitting here from many miles away looking at American politics, it was clear that there was a strong part of President Trump's support base that came to him because they were tired of America's involvement in these wars. Right. They wanted an American government that detached itself from interfering across the world, committing American resources to global projects, so to speak, and putting American lives at risk when there are so many challenges to be tackled on the home front. If we give President Trump the benefit of the doubt, he came to office this time around seeking to bring an end to America's involvement in all these wars. Others would say that he never meant any of that, and he was always just going to be the next version of, you know, the United States as a belligerent military power. Either way, what we have now is 6 months on, a White House whose entire posture towards the Ukraine conflict has done a 180-degree turn. And now, is that because President Trump actually had no intentions of trying to bring peace to the table? Or is it because he's been maneuvered there by those who had a very strong interest in perpetuating the war? Different people have a different view on that, but whichever way you analyze this, the end result is the United States and President Trump version 2.0 has now, in effect, taken over the baton and is owning this conflict. From Russia's point of view, it's pretty clear that it's business as usual. President Putin spoke at an event of business and industrialists earlier this year, where he was asked specifically about the discussions that were happening with the US and whether or not that may lead to a change in economic policy conditions for Russia. And he actually said at the time, don't expect any change in the global sanctions environment. So even then, there was no expectation that there was, even if embassies were reopened and there was a, let's call it a quasi-normalization of diplomatic dialogue, that there was going to be any substantial change per se. We are where we're at. The United States remains entangled in a conflict that it has played a big role in for well over a decade in creating the conditions for conflict, and it actually has no way out, and certainly no way out in a manner that would satisfy the the emotional requirements that often come with being a major power, and that is to get out of a war that it can't win and is arguably on the losing end without being humiliated. Mm-hmm. So this was the problem the United States has faced in a whole range of its other conflicts it's been involved in over the course of the last 50 years. The Vietnam War is a classic case in point. When the Pentagon Papers, which were leaked by Ginsburg, showed that the people inside the Beltway knew well in advance of the United States finally leaving Vietnam that the United States could not win that battle and that it was going to cause incredible amount of destruction of Vietnam and involve the loss of tens of thousands of American lives. Those inside the Beltway knew. And yet they could not bring an end to that for a number of years afterwards because of the concern that the reputational damage would be so great that the American war machine and its power projection capabilities across the globe could not recover. Afghanistan's been the same. Iraq has been the same. In all of those examples, the United States has entered into a war. It got ensnared in warfare that it couldn't win. In fact, was on the wrong end of the stick progressively as time went by. And it had to figure out a way of getting out. The escape out of Kabul, you know, a few years ago, in many ways symbolized or captured the Biden term's failure on this front. Right. And I think we're looking at the prospects that at some point the collapse of Kiev will be President Trump's version of the same. The worry I have in terms of the perpetuation of these wars and conflicts and the people who are dying is because President Trump is acutely aware of this reputational risk that he will seek to push this out as long as he can now so that it becomes a problem for the 48th president of the United States.
Yeah, and that would be very, very tragic. And that's there are allegedly statements of Trump saying that he knows that Ukraine can't win. And in my mind, if you know they can't win, then why would you continue to arm them when all it's doing is prolonging the suffering of both Russians and Ukrainians, honestly? It's tragic. While we're kind of on this whole axis of evil, if you will, when we're talking about, you know, Russia and China here, one thing I'm really curious about is China's relationship when it comes to Iran. So I believe last time I had Jason on, he had actually informed me, and I didn't know this until he told me about it, but China actually provided medical aid to both Gaza and Israel. So this whole conflict, as Trump dubbed it, the 12-day war, which I don't think is over yet. I think there's still, this could warm back up again. Do you think that the U.S. striking Iran had kind of changed the way that China looks at Iran and Israel? Or how do you think they're kind of looking at that specific area in the Middle East in those conflicts?
Look, certainly in terms of China's public, the attitudes towards the United States and the attitudes towards Israel have deteriorated substantially over the course of the last 18 months. The situation in Gaza now has, I think, fundamentally destroyed whatever threads of goodwill and good perceptions there were from the broader Chinese public towards both Israel and the United States. And that's going to be, I think, very difficult for the US reputationally to actually recover from. In terms of the government itself, it's obviously provided aid, as you described, but I think there is a strategic recognition that the dynamics or the configuration of forces and interests in that region have now been irrevocably and dangerously changed. So the interventions of the United States the bombing of the nuclear program facilities has delivered actually the obverse of what the objective was. Mm-hmm. If the aim was to cause Iran to cease its nuclear enrichment program and the development of, or the potential development of, nuclear weapons, what this bombing has done is caused Iran to double down. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the year, Iran becomes a genuine nuclear power in terms of having the capacity, if not already the warheads. And that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Iran, I think, has very little incentive now to not do that. In fact, because of the attack on them, initially by Israeli forces and then eventually by the Americans, it has actually every reason to go down this path. Now, that's very dangerous because nuclear proliferation creates more risks. Neither China nor Russia actually want to see this happen. So in that sense, all the nuclear powers have the same view, right? All the major nuclear powers anyway. Those with nuclear weapons never want anyone else to get them. But it's going to become increasingly difficult, Kyle, I think, for China or Russia to persuade the Iranians to not do this. And that's probably one of the reasons why there's a likelihood, a high likelihood, that the Americans will go back in. President Trump, of course, has been speaking strongly about America's intent and willingness and capability to do it again. And ironically, of course, had the first run of strikes been as successful as President Trump originally said that they were, there'd actually be no need for him to talk like this about the potential risk of Iran developing its nuclear program going forward. So what this tells us, of course, is that the first round of strikes failed miserably, not only in terms of destroying the program, but in fact, it as I just said, it's actually incentivized Iran to double down and hurry up. This conflict, the real danger in this conflict, I think, is that it's exposed Israel in ways that Israel never anticipated that it would be exposed militarily. It is weaker today than it's ever been. And secondly, and this is probably something that the United States didn't bank on, but it has been significant collateral damage, not just reputationally in terms of what's going on in Gaza, but the limitations of the American military projection machine has been shown very clearly. The fact that Iranian attacks on Israel clearly penetrated the so-called Iron Dome, that American ground-to-air anti-missile technologies ultimately were shown to be inadequate and insufficient, not to mention the fact that the months-long campaign against the Houthis failed to a point where the United States ultimately reached a ceasefire agreement with the Houthis and left the Red Sea. So none of this shows the American military capability in a good light. The problem with that is that, you know, again, sitting here from the outside, the pattern seems to be that whenever America worries about its declining reputation militarily, it thinks that it needs to find somewhere or somebody to go and prove that it still has it. So it's going to go and bomb someone else to remind the world that it has the ability to bomb someone else.
Yeah, and it's a very, very sad pattern, because it always seems like every 4 years we want to elect the person who runs on ending wars and ending conflicts. But then as soon as they get in, we kind of laid it out a little bit earlier, but their incentive is always to create more and more war, which just is, it shouldn't be that way. We should want more and more win-win cooperation and agreements with the world. So I know we're a little short on time. We got a few more minutes, but I really want to ask you about AUKUS and kind of the Australian perspective on the U.S. and China, because I know that, I think it was during Biden's term. I want to say it might have been 2021 or 2022. They started moving some nuclear weapons over there. And obviously there's the Philippines, where there's disputed reefs between China and the Philippines. I know this isn't particularly straight, you know, referring to AUKUS, but kind of that whole block where it's supposed to be what, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the US basically gearing up an alliance targeted at China.
Yeah, look, I'll try and keep this reasonably brief. I mean, it's a long story in a sense, and I've talked a bit about that on a few other shows recently. So, you know, people can probably find the longer version elsewhere. But I'll do my best here to give, again, a snapshot for your viewers and community. Firstly, the United States has a strong military presence in the Western Pacific or right across Asia. It has military bases in a number of countries, Japan, Korea, and in effect now, again, the Philippines. Those military bases have weapon systems that are designed and pointed at China. And there are also some 70 or 80,000 American service personnel located in these countries ready to operate these machines in a war. Why are they there? Well, they've been in this part of the world and also on the island of Taiwan, on and off since the end of the Second World War and since the end of most of the Civil War in China in 1949, mainly with the intent of containing what was always seen as communism. So it was either to contain the Soviets, particularly in Vietnam, but underlying all of this was the attempt to contain China as a communist threat, so to speak. The containment of China was wrapped up in, I think, a broader mindset. And this mindset goes all the way back to the days when American missionaries were flooding China, late 1800s, right through to the first few decades of the 20th century. And the aim was to, in effect, prosecute, for some people, a civilizational war. So in 1951, when Joseph McCarthy, the famous senator who began the anti-communist campaigns in the United States, he criticized the State Department in a speech for essentially conceding China. So in the 1950s, a big debate in the United States was this question of who lost China. And for them, losing China was not only a geopolitical thing, but it was a civilizational, spiritual thing. And McCarthy made that very, very clear in the in his speech when he talked about Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of the KMT, the forces that the communists defeated, as being our guy fighting our war. Right? And he meant by that an anti-communist civilizational war, where McCarthy framed the communists as being godless. Okay, so that's a piece of that sort of ongoing impetus that's always been there. So from China's point of view, of course, being surrounded by all of these bases, controlled and by a country that has for many, many decades had a largely hostile attitude towards it, was a great concern. So China, of course, has been modernizing its military capabilities ever since then in response to that. Mm-hmm. The AUKUS question, I think, is a function of the increasingly evident military limitations of the United States itself. So we touched on the problems that emerged as a result of the situation in the Middle East, and in fact, you'd say the same about the problems in Ukraine. And so what the United States has been doing, despite the rhetoric of the pivot to Asia, which was under Obama, it's actually been reconfiguring its commitments and exposure in Asia itself. So much like that discussion we had right at the outset about the decentralization of the global system, mm-hmm. the United States used to run its alliance network literally via a hubs and spokes model. So it had singular bilateral treaty agreements with its different allies, whether they were, you know, the former colonies like the Philippines, sub-imperial allies like Australia, or client states like Japan and Korea. However, because of the physical and financial limitations, it's been changing that progressively to a series of these so-called mini-laterals, which are Japan, Australia, the US. Japan, Philippines, US, AUKUS, UK, Australia, United States. So it's a whole series of these much smaller relationships, including Quad as well. And part of that rationale is to push responsibility further out to the subordinate partners, if you will. At the same time, it's physically retreating, not because its objectives have changed. It's not retreating from Asia because it doesn't want to project power. It's retreating physically because it understands its limitations, and it's recalibrating its strategic orientation whilst keeping in place the long-held, multi-decades doctrine of global hegemony in all parts of the world, global primacy. So the US physically is pulling some troops out of Okinawa. It's going back to Guam. It's making these other allies really take up positions on the front line far more. And so AUKUS came along, former Australian Prime Minister came up with the idea. He wanted to build a tighter connection between Australia and the United States. And the idea of the United States providing Australia with US designed and built nuclear submarines came into being. The problem, of course, is that firstly, the United States can't make enough submarines for itself. So that's the first problem. So in Australia, there is now a growing debate, increasingly intense, about the folly of this entire proposition simply on practical terms. Even if it was the right strategic decision, and there's a different debate about that, on practical terms, the United States can't make enough anyway, so it was a silly thing to do. On strategic terms, there is also a debate, which is essentially, what's the point of nuclear submarines insofar as defending Australia itself is concerned? Because nuclear submarines are purpose designed for long periods at sea, and a long way away from your shores. They're actually not designed for defending your near regions. So clearly they are forward offensive attack submarines. So the question was always, is that really the right thing to be doing as far as Australian defence is concerned? And so increasingly now this debate's unfolding. Elbridge Colby kicked off a review, about 5 weeks ago. He's always been a skeptic, actually, of whether the United States can afford to build and provide these submarines to Australia. I suspect in the end, the review will say, well, the US really shouldn't be doing this unless it's got enough submarines, but we'll keep charging the Australians and they can keep paying, but we'll never give them any guarantees that they'll get the submarines. Why not, in a sense? From America's point of view, send the bill, collect the money, and, if the submarines get delivered, they get delivered. If they don't, they don't. So this is the dilemma now that Australia faces in relation to AUKUS itself. Politically, both parties are committed to it in part because they're trapped. They're trapped by their own fear of each other, accusing the other of going weak on national security. Mm. Right? So they've become self-reinforcing, trapped in the AUKUS arrangement. The UK came to Australia, the Defence Minister came to Australia for the UK-Australia Defence Minister and Foreign Minister meeting earlier this week, late last week, and recommitting to all of this stuff, and in fact, the UK Defence Minister says, well, the UK is ready to, come in and fight the war over Taiwan. The UK can barely get its boats out, get its navy out of its own docks in its own backyard, let alone come all the way to Asia, to relive fantasies of former glory days of Imperium, right? But there we are, so the UK is wanting to come into Asia to have a war. The United States really is wanting all of its partners to take on more burdens, but it can't actually supply any of the materials. You've got Australia thinking, where on earth is all of this going now? But we're both major parties are trapped into this. So it's all of a bit of a, let's call it a strategic muddle and a strategic mess from the point of view of a small country like Australia.
Ugh, what a mess. Well, Warwick, I know you had a little bit of a time limit, and I want to be respectful of your time. This was incredibly informative, and I'm very, very grateful we got to make this happen. Please tell everybody where they could find you, support you with all that good stuff, and hopefully we get to talk again soon.
Look, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, and I'm glad that we sorted out the time zone coordination problems. It's always a bit of an issue, particularly in Australia, where we're, you know, anywhere from, you know, 8 to 15, 17 hours ahead of others. It is a big effort, so thank you. People can find my work predominantly at Substack. So Warwick Powell at Substack, .substack.com is probably the best place. And look, I'd be more than happy to come back and, help answer any questions coming from your audience and continue to have the conversation, to try. Most of this is helpful for me, to be honest, Carl. Mm-hmm. These conversations help me understand the things that concern people, and that's mm-hmm. important, but they also help me think about things as well. And they're just learning experiences, and if we can educate people and help people make better decisions and arrive at a clearer understanding of the craziness of our world, and hopefully as a result of that contribute to reducing the risk of conflict and increasing the prospects of collaboration around, you know, shared prosperity and shared sustainability, then great, you know, count me in.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely the goal of the show here. I try to have as many people on from all over the world with different viewpoints, but I think we all join kind of hands in the respect of being anti-war and wanting to see human prosperity all around the world. We have differing visions of how that may manifest, but I think we all kind of want less war and more human prosperity. So, Warwick, any more closing thoughts? If not, we'll wrap her up there.
I think you've said it beautifully. Less war, more human prosperity.
Thank you so much, Warwick. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, everybody, take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.